The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll, I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is a program that focuses upon a single issue, inviting some of the most enlightened minds in the world to share their perspective. We also select topics that are either not dealt with by the mainstream media or dealt with from an official position, either official left or official right, but never with any sense of independent thought. Today, our program will explore the history and legacy of the founding of the Department of Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. Also, for those of you who are concerned about surveillance in America, increasing militarization of our police, and a lot of unanswered questions that are not even raised by the mainstream media, such as, can someone give us a detailed explanation of why, when criminal acts are uncovered by federal agencies like the CIA or the Homeland Security, that no one's ever prosecuted. In fact, to this day, there have not been any major prosecutions from the FBI from Operation COINTELPRO. Why? Why should we have two standards? Also, if an act is committed that can be proven by international treaty of which we are signatory to have occurred, why is it that those who perpetrated the crime are not punished, at least up to this point, and were given the impression that they never will be, such as lying about weapons of mass destruction? We're going to talk about FEMA detention camps that have been created. Historically, if you mention any such thing, first you were written off as, well, a conspiratorial nut. And secondly, if someone had to acknowledge they existed, it was simply to take care of the overflow of undocumented aliens. Maybe that's the case. Let's explore that. We're going to ask about something that's concerning the 130-year-old Posse Comitatus Act, which forbids the military's role in domestic law enforcement. Well, according to the Washington Post, the Pentagon expects 20,000 military troops in the United States with the mission to train state and local police officials, and an additional group to work through different police agencies in order to protect against any form of civil disobedience. And then we had the 30,000 drones. About 7 days ago, it was announced the Pentagon would work with the Federal Aviation Administration to open up U.S. airspace to drones or robotic aircraft. Earlier, the FAA did not permit drones to operate in national airspace. Congress approved 30,000 drones for domestic use. Why? Are these to be flown over the border with Mexico to prevent drug trade? No, these are going to be all over the place. But there's new information about what they're having as a part of their makeup and how some of these new drones are being equipped so that they can sense sound and heat motion, hence a full image of a person in their home or a building, and listen to their conversations. Does that have anyone concerned? This new bill follows up the Army's January directive to use drone fleets in the U.S. for training missions and domestic operations. And both of these initiatives are mandated in the National Defense Appropriation Act, Section 1097, that calls for 6 drone test ranges to be operational within 6 months, and that bill signing is done. The commercial drone market would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars when that happens. That is our program. To join us in this program to give their learned input will be 3 professors. We will have Professor Paul Craig Roberts. He is one of today's most progressive analytical and economic thinkers and commentators. He talks about the state of the nation, government dysfunction, political corruption, global and domestic economic threats and decay, our wars on terror in the Middle East, our conflicts, 9/11, and the decline in human values in American society. He was an Assistant Secretary of Treasury during Ronald Reagan's first term, and is a former editor and columnist with the Wall Street Journal. He writes for Global Research, Counterpunch, Creator Syndicate, Op-Ed News, and LouRockwell.com. He's published many books during 40 years, the latest being How the Economy Was Lost, The War of the Worlds. We'll also be joined by Professor James Petras. Professor Petras is the Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in New York and an expert in American interference in global politics, especially Latin America and the Middle East. He has a long commitment to social justice issues and workers' rights and was a member of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Repression in Latin America. He is also the recipient of many awards, including the Distinguished Service Award from the American Sociological Society, the Robert Kennedy Award for his best book in that field. He has written 62 books in 29 languages. He has published over 600 articles in professional journals. His editorials have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, The Guardian, La Mode, and several in Latin America. His most recent book is The Arab Revolt and the Imperialist Counterattack. And finally, we will be hearing from Professor Andrew Colin. He is a professor of political science at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York, where he specializes in American political thought and civil liberties, U.S. foreign policy, and constitutional law. Much of his recent work has focused on the conflicts between state power and democracy and the history of the U.S. turning into a police state. His latest book published this year is State Power and Democracy, Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush, which traces the history of American politics for sowing the seeds for a national police state from the founding of the Republic to the present day. I welcome all three of you gentlemen to our program.
Thank you for having me on your program.
I'm going to start in reverse order. I'm going to begin with you, Professor Cullen. I want to first establish, so there at least we have some perimeter, of what you might accurately perceive as a police state.
Sure.
So I would like for you and then the other two to tell me briefly the defining characteristics that are most common in recognizing police states throughout history.
Sure. I'd like to go over some of the basic features of a police state. First and foremost, and this is very characteristic, and I would identify the United States as being a police state, as I discussed in my book, is an ongoing state of national emergency, which had been declared by President Bush on September 14, 2001, and was then further extended by Obama in January of 2009. Now, under a state of national emergency, essentially there is the elimination of rule of law of the U.S. Constitution, and the state has the ability to take on extraordinary measures. And again, if you look at what happened in post-9/11 America, what we see is a number of draconian measures which are quite similar to any other police state. Just to cite one particular example, we have, for instance, in Nazi Germany, the infamous decree of, known as the Reichstag Fire Decree of September 27, 1933, which was then followed by the even more infamous Enabling Act of March 1933, which again made essentially Germany into a police state. So the state of a national emergency is the essential prerequisite which other than follow the elimination of procedural due process, the essential curtailment of civil liberties. We see, as in America of post-9/11 to the present time, very characteristic of police states is ongoing preventive detention. We see Guantanamo Bay, Bagram, and other places. We see also that the concentration of power is within one part of the government. So essentially the U.S. police state, like all the others, is can be best characterized as a state within a state, a national security state. And the overall goal is to expand the power of the state, to give it absolute power and to extend ever greater control over people and territory.
So could I then surmise that that would mean that there would be a no balance of power between security and personal rights, since all state actions are justified in the name of national security, and the concentration of that power that you just mentioned within a branch of the government also is at the executive level, which you didn't mention, but doesn't that also mean that any other agencies of our society, such as the media, if they challenge this, in all likelihood would themselves become victims of that outreach and overreach of the police state?
Well, the corporate media is very much a part of the police state. They've been in service of it. Just look at the follow-up to the invasion of Iraq and ever since. What, again, we find in the United States, and what I mean by national security state, is that within that national security state, you have all these agencies which answer to the head of that national security state, which is the President of the United States, and which power is concentrated in that one branch, and which always, I repeat, always you have in a police state is that security trumps civil liberties, because the simple proclamation is that the country is in a state of emergency and that extreme measures have to be taken. And this has been a consistent part of U.S. history, which we don't often hear from the corporate media.
All right. Then I have one more question at this time for you before we go to other panelists. Right now, for the first time in probably 35, maybe even as much as 40 years, there's a new movement among mainly younger and idealistic college students, some with Ron Paul, some with the Occupy movement, but only probably 1%, based upon the numbers I've seen, that they want to establish some resistance to this incursion upon our rights. They're not focused completely on this. They're mainly against those who wield such power and control over our government as Wall Street. But this is my issue. You find evidence that points to resistance to democracy and the repression of public dissent among early founding fathers of the country. And this has been the groundwork for all later acts and policies that have built an increasing state power at the cost of real democracy. So could you give us a sampling of the earliest evidence in American history for the state control being embedded in the nation's origins, so that the younger people today, the people who are doing what we did in the 60s against Vietnam and then later against the state overreach and the CIA, and they're needing some lessons in history to show this is not a unique and immediate occurrence. This has been going on for a long time. So could you provide that for us,
sure,
please?
Sure. Just very briefly, if you look at post-Revolutionary War America, what became the concerns of the what I call the political elite, so that there was too much democracy. Look at the transition from the Articles of Confederation then to the establishment of the Constitution. This was exactly the fear. And then when you look at Jay's Rebellion and you look at other events, the elites became concerned and they wanted to concentrate power in a centralized government. And then what we start to see is the articulation, if I may borrow Stalin's words, is from this point in time to the present, the identification of enemies of the state. There have been various enemies of the state, from Native Americans to African Americans to labor to women to socialists, all throughout the 19th and into the 20th century. But if you look at what always follows is, therefore, again, as I argued in my book, the state has to take extreme measures. And one of the first that appears, and this is ongoing up to the Patriot Act, is in 1796 we have the first of many decrees, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were, again, followed by so many other up to the present ones.
One last question for you on this issue. A lot of people on the left herald back to FDR and the Roosevelt's New Deal as the direction our government should take now. However, do you have any research, particularly regarding the meetings between President Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover, the man he succeeded, that there's evidence for the policies behind the New Deal that would lead the U.S. to becoming a true police state?
Well, that's interesting you raise FDR and Hoover, because they had a secret meeting in which verbally FDR gave Hoover the go-ahead to expand the surveillance by the FBI on dissidents, and not just communist, but anyone who was deemed to be an enemy of the state at the time. And there, from that point in time, we see an enormous acceleration by Hoover of spying, not just the internment of Japanese, but then we see leading right into the 1950s of the Contempo program, which, as you've discussed many times on your program, which started to target different groups. And all presidents have been on board on this, Democrats, Republicans, and that they are very much concerned in expanding their power at the expense of democracy. And this has been the direction of U.S. state power from post-Revolutionary War to the present.
Okay. Please hold your thoughts, Professor Andrew Cullen. We'll come back to you. But now I want to go over and say hello to our next guest in order, Professor James Petras. Nice to have you back with us, sir.
Very good. It's been a pleasure working with you in the past, and I look forward to our session today, Gary.
Good. I'm concerned that the average American simply does not understand the consequences or potential consequences to them or their rights when an administration and Congress supports a Patriot Act or Homeland Security Act or any other act that abridges their rights. Most people don't know what is in the Constitution. They've never read it. Most don't know the Bill of Rights. They've never read them. Most people just assume, as long as I'm not doing anything wrong, I have nothing to fear. I shouldn't fear my government. My government's there to protect me. And then, by extension, they hear people such as Bill O'Reilly say, once we entered the conflict and the war began, if you're not with America, then you are the enemy, equating anyone who might challenge the rightness of our military intervention in Iraq as an enemy of the people and pillaring people as such. And then we had Glenn Beck doing the same and Sean Hannity. And unfortunately, there was not a mass movement through the Democratic apparatuses and the unions to really take this issue about the erosion of our rights to the people. There was no general strike called. There was no March on Washington called. I was surprised, and I thought, well, what happened to the Democrats on this? What happened to the real constitutional and civil liberties-loving Republicans and libertarians? Where are they? And I did not see them. A few lonely voices, Judge Napolitano, Ron Paul. I didn't see anyone. And I was embarrassed. Tell us what you see in the larger perspective, the dangers of the unbridled power that the government has, the Patriot Act, which increases government surveillance in four areas. It records searches. It expands the government's ability to look at records on an individual's activity being held by third parties. That's Section 215. It's all secret searches. It expands the government's ability to search your private property without notice. Section 213, the intelligence searches. It expands a narrow exception to the Fourth Amendment that's been created for the collection of foreign data. But they can do that with anyone now. And the Patriot Act unconstitutionally amends the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure to allow a government to conduct searches without notifying the subject, at least until long after the search has been executed. This means that the government can enter a house, enter an apartment, go into your office with a search warrant when you're not there, search and photograph or seize your property, take anything they want, and not tell you till long ago. So the average American simply clueless on this. Give us your perspective on this, please.
I think whether it's openly expressed or in private discontent, people are aware of the dangers of opposing the government. It takes a huge swindle like the bailout of Wall Street to arouse people's indignation and hostility. And you remember the outpouring of protest when the first bailout announcement was made and the Congress withheld it for a few weeks and then went back. There's a sense of intimidation that's very generalized, and what makes it worse is it's not openly expressed, but it's not willing to be identified as opposing the state. That's the worst kind of police state, when the citizens have internalized their fear. And I think the case that's most salient right now is the point at which the president can issue a fatwa or a fiat that an American citizen can be assassinated and without restrictions of time or place. And Obama has crossed that line where assassination is part of foreign policy or security policy, and that takes it all to an all-time new level. The second thing I think that's crucial is the economic and political basis of political terrorism. I think the launching of sequential wars, beginning with Iraq, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the intervention in the Middle East supporting Israel's invasion of Lebanon and Gaza, there's a perpetual war machine that's operating and that needs to protect its capacity to carry on these wars. Now, the thing about these wars is that they don't provide any payoffs for domestic population. In other words, we have imperial expansion and domestic decay, and the police state is inserted in that context. It's also being strengthened in the face of the tremendous recovery that capital has made at the cost of American living standards. That's the context where this police state operates today. I know a lot of listeners talk about the crisis of capitalism, but 2011 was a record year for profits in the United States, and not just the banks, General Motors, and in terms of the percentage of earnings that accrued through profits. The profit margins were enormous last year, and labor has got its living standards are declining, and the horrendous shedding of labor, the most savage firing of work. Workers today are fired with 5 seconds notice. There's no protection, there's no severance pay, there's nothing. And this is part of this world of intimidation and terror. It exists on an everyday basis today, and it expresses itself somewhat very casually. It's not been generalized, but the state at various levels, local, state, has smashed these campsites of the Occupy movement forcefully in Oakland, in New York, and elsewhere. They went in with the police club and drove peaceful protesters out, and of course they devise some bureaucratic pretext like the issue of sanitation or security. But the fact of the matter is, if this had happened in Russia, if Putin had sent the police in to a peaceful protest, it would have been screaming headlines. But it happens here, and it's routinized repression. So you got routinized repression. You have tremendous intimidation at the workplace. You have this constant surveillance by Homeland Security. They collect millions of items every day, fax, emails, text messages. The only question you raise is how can they process and make any sense? But the fact of the matter is, there's a database for tens of millions of Americans today. This isn't a small leftist group. We're talking about the mainstream of America today is in a data bank controlled by a security agency, more a spy agency. We talked about the KGB having informers, etc. Well, every one of your computers today is an informer because it's tapped by Homeland Security, and it's a huge apparatus today. It's been publicly admitted that all the mosques in the United States are under surveillance. They profile thousands of people that go and engage in religious activity. This is part of a general process of control that has its roots in the constant wars, the build-up now against China. Obama talks about welcoming Chinese cooperation. Meantime, we're stationing the naval armada right off the shores of China. We're building up a whole complex of alliances to confront China. Putting missiles next to Russia. All of these military aggressions require this kind of terror operation in the United States, because if there's any fallout, they have it in place to intimidate, but they don't have to actually use it, because they've created a police culture that's occupying people's minds. And I think that's the ultimate defense. And one of the reasons why in Greece, in Portugal, in Spain, and other countries, there are mass protests, because they don't have this police apparatus, and people have their independent organizations. And we have a civil society in the United States that's no longer civil. It's penetrated at all different levels. And the policing isn't simply by official government police. You have trade union officials that purge unions that have critical views. You have universities that are purged by collaborators with the U.S. government, especially on issues of the Middle East. Especially any critic of Israel is subject to tremendous pressures and harassment, and this is an extension of the state. In other words, the police state isn't just the state. The state is the mainspring out of which we have a whole panoply of organizations that police down to the neighborhood level.
I appreciate those insights. One more general question for you, but it's going to have several parts, and it'll take me just a moment to outline it. Then please address these as you wish, all right?
Yes.
I would like to pull back for a moment and look at this a little philosophically and a little of it existentially, and here's what I'd like to say. On the one hand, we have about 19% of the population, adult population, that identify themselves as conservative and Republican. We have about 21% identify themselves as liberal and Democrat. 41% identify themselves as independent, and within that 41%, about now 15% as progressives, who at one time, those independents, progressives, were your official either a Republican, conservative, or liberal Democrat. Now, today, between the official Democrats and the official Republicans, you have one group of people, the Koch brothers or other multinationals. It's not a lot. It's only about 141 major corporations that have an undue amount of influence. They have more power because they control banks and other things, and a lot of control over the media. And so the message is this. If you were a person who was supposedly a small government Republican, or you were and believed in constitutional rights, then where are your leaders today, since your party has gone to major government, the largest governmental expansion in history, starting with Ronald Reagan until today? And you have less rights now today and more government control over your lives than ever before, with bloated bureaucracies that no one is going into to see who do they work for, what do they do. On the other hand, you have your historical Democrats and liberals that are supposed to be there as safety nets, ideological and political safety nets for the poor, the middle class, the unions, the environment. And yet they officially have allowed through Clinton wars of aggression, being lied to. The unions were sold out with NAFTA. The American public was sold out when Phil Gramm and Robert Rubin, the Secretary of the Treasury, and Larry Summers, who would later become Secretary of Treasury, worked with President Clinton on eviscerating the Glass-Steagall Act, taking it away and modifying the Commodity Future Trading Act. As a result, it was derivatives, have a good time, credit default swaps, the world is yours. People weren't aware of this. They weren't sophisticated enough. But also, what we did in Serbia, it was a crime against humanity, and yet we made it look like, you know, we were going to bring them. And by the way, Clinton and his administration have never been held accountable for what they did in Serbia and Bosnia and Croatia. All we saw was a guy who looked like he was in a concentration camp, emaciated. What we now know, what we now officially can say, is that was a British film crew on the inside of a camp filming out. And that man that was not suffering from malnutrition, that man that was in the cover of Time magazine, all these others, justifying, we got to go to war, look at these people. That man had a genetic defect, and that's why he was that way, had been before and was afterwards. That doesn't mean there weren't crimes against humanity committed on all sides, but we were lied to. Clinton lied to us, his Defense Department lied to us, the neocons lied to us, but it was a liberal lie. And therefore, if it's a liberal or Democrat lie, somehow it's supposed to be cleaner. If there's your constitutional rights are invaded by a Democrat or a liberal, it's supposed to be okay. Because it's, you know, it can't be that bad because, after all, he's a Democrat. He's pro-union. No, he's not pro-union. He's pro-globalization. So now what we have is we have the people who are supposed to protect the poor abandon the poor. And that started under Clinton with his Welfare Act. And now today, no one is stopping the home foreclosures. No one. The banks that are part of that have now gotten out of jail free. And they got not only just that TARP of $700 billion, but they also got three successive quantitative easings, two of those in complete secrecy. Now we know it was over $16 trillion minimally. And not a penny went to the American public. We knew that the corporations got money. It all went to the main corporations with a tiny amount trickling down, but an inordinate amount went to people involved in the military-industrial complex and this spy complex. So now we have, in effect, private militias. We have people running prisons. We have people spying on us, not directly employed by a Department of Defense, but a private contractor. They're in the business of making money. If they are shown not to be needed, if what they do is not needed, then we don't need to give them that contract. But no one ever loses their contract, even Halliburton, when they charge $100 to wash a duffel bag that should cost a quarter of clothes for GI in Iraq. No one ever cancels these contracts. Once you're in that loop of living on the gravy train, it never ends. So everything that the Democrats and liberals were supposed to be about, they have betrayed. Everything the conservatives and Republicans were supposed to, at their idealistic best, were supposed to be about, they betrayed. And yet, today, Obama is increasing in popularity and will be, without question, the next president. If he did nothing, he'd be the next president, because college-educated women, the African-American community, and a lot of the intelligentsia are going to vote for him without asking a basic question. Do we have more rights today or less? Is the plight of the average person, working person, middle class, poor person, people on Social Security, is our environment better or worse? Are we more likely to have a sustainable future or less? No one is asking these questions. And yet all of these would be in the negative. The man who promotes clean coal, the man who promotes, you know, the nuclear industry, but nothing at all ever about sea power, wave power, or getting out of the wars or conflicts or demilitarizing us. And so you say, well, my God, then the truth is not here. And yet the media is controlled by either the official left or the official right. From the Nation magazine, even radio shows, there's a line. Rachel Maddow won't cross that line. Keith Emmerich won't cross that line. He even brings these people on. So then where in the hell are people supposed to go to get the truth on any of this, since they're controlling the argument? They're controlling the dialogue. They're controlling what's important to their cause and not ours. That's a lot to think about, but please take what have I just said and address it.
I think that you paint a concentration of power in official sources that's reflective of reality. But the question is, how much of an impact does it have? When we saw the bailout was first announced, over 70% of Americans rejected it, despite all the media supporting it, despite the Democratic Party supporting it, despite Obama, despite the Republicans. The same thing when the Occupy Wall Street movement. All the opinion polls showed 70 to 80% of Americans supported the issues that were raised, that the pointing the finger at Wall Street and the ripoff of American Treasury, American taxpayers. If you look at the polls on the wars today, Afghanistan, Iraq, they have to camouflage it because the great majority of Americans are opposed to them. If we look at this whole problem of police stating, if you ask people straight out, do you support surveillance? Do you support Homeland Security tapping into your computer and looking at your messages, your phone messages? I'm sure that the majority of American people would reject that. I'm not saying that they have a clear notion of the system that generates this, but I'm sure that when you point to Medicare, Medicaid, even Tea Party people, the majority of them say they're in favor of Social Security. And yet, what's clear is that there's a tremendous breach, a tremendous gap between these groups that you mentioned, this political class, this political elite, especially among the liberals, and the people that they're supposed to be addressing. There's a tremendous breach. And the question is, why and how does that large-scale current of opinion that supports Social Security, that wants to end imperial wars that are so costly, that is it wants greater employment security, our employment. We have 20% of Americans that are unemployed, underemployed, and stop looking for jobs. They certainly are not in favor of the system. But what's the crucial question is the tremendous obstacles to organizing those large-scale, long-term currents of opinion into a political force. Now, most of the left intellectuals, New York City and elsewhere, they meet in these social forums and they debate and they discuss and they have coffee together, etc. But nothing happens from these forums. I attended the original social forum in Rio Grande do Sul in Porto Alegre, and I was appalled. There are all kinds of panels and discussions, and nothing organized came out of it. When the big strikes took place in Greece and in Brazil, etc., the social forums weren't there. It was the landless rural workers. We marched down the landed estates, etc. So I think we have a disjuncture here between the political class and the vast majority of Americans who are developing a tremendous malaise. And to some degree, as perverse as this sounds, some of the right-wing groups that are organized, like the Tea Party, are capturing this unstructured hostility and putting it in a context that's even worse for most people. But nevertheless, there is that organized form. And the left in the United States, maybe something will come out of the Green Party. They have a wonderful candidate, a woman named Stein. There are local organizations engaged in various kinds of protests. But we don't have a structure, an institutional, organizational, or movement structure that can pull these opinions together into a political force. And that's the great dilemma that we face today. But I don't think people are sleeping through this. There's a great deal of discontent under the surface. And one way it will express itself, and I can guarantee you this, there'll be close to 50% abstention in these elections because people will say, neither party represents me. Both parties are against me.
Well,
and I think that 50% opinion that will not be expressed in the electoral process needs to be organized.
We're doing exactly that. I got Ralph Nader to speak with Ron Paul. I got Ron Paul and Ralph Nader to speak with Dr. Stein. I got Rocky Anderson to speak with. So we are, trust me, there's an awful lot of movement to get some of the most independent progressive minds dialoguing, not for now. This current election cycle is lost. And unfortunately, some major environmental catastrophes are likely to happen, will not be addressed. But in the next 3, 4, 5 years, because I believe it's going to get a lot worse, and when people begin to protest, and then they're arrested for protesting, just peaceful protesting, and at some point, it depends upon what happens in Greece, but my prediction is that Greece will go off the charts as far as throwing out the corrupt government they have, and saying no and going off the euro and finding their own currency. There's a $26 trillion position in credit default swaps right now, the 5 leading banks in the United States. That's a hidden ticking financial time bomb that's going to go off. If Greece defaults, they're going to lose that. Then you'll see how quickly the Federal Reserve comes to their aid, but not a penny to the average American. This information is going to, when we see what happens in Greece, we see what happens in Portugal, and from Greece, Portugal, Spain, one of the largest demonstrations in Spain's history just happened in the last 3 days. You wouldn't know it from watching the American media. But it's happening elsewhere. It's going to end up happening here, maybe not immediately, but within the next 2 years. But hold your thoughts for Professor James Petras, again, Bartol, Professor Emeritus of Sociology. And now let's go over and say hello to our final panelist, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. Professor Roberts, thank you for being with us again.
Yes, pleased to be with you.
Professor Roberts, I want you to address several issues, if you would, please. Could you give us your perspective and knowledge on FEMA camps, detention camps? Are they in place now? Were they, and are they still, primarily or exclusively to, as what we've been led to believe, for excess illegal immigrants, or as some have feared or suspected, in case there is civil disobedience in the United States when people begin to protest their own government's actions, that they could be arrested? And give us your perspective on what it means to stand up today, yourself included, all three of you, as you know, because of your positions, your reputation, the people you reach, your credibility. It's needless to say you're certainly on these lists, but anyone who speaks up today is on these lists. What does it mean when we're supposed to have a constitutional right to, in a peaceful way, nonviolent way, to make our grievances known to our government, and yet the government considers now, and the FBI has so gone on the record because we got it under Freedom of Information Act, they are now looking at people who protest as terrorists and putting them on terrorist watch list. Your thoughts on where we are at in a police state at this moment?
Well, Gary, I don't know about the FEMA camps. All I know is there were newspaper reports several years ago that Halliburton had been given a contract from the United States government of $385 million to build camps or whatever they call them. I don't know where they are, and I don't know what the purpose is. As I see our dilemma, we now have an executive branch that's unaccountable. It's simply unaccountable. There's no rule of law. And as the other participants in this program have said, the President of the United States can murder Americans. He can throw them in dungeons without habeas corpus due process. He can behave like a medieval robber baron. And there's no accountability, and they can violate law. We saw that Bush violated the Surveillance Act and spied on Americans without warrants. That's the Each occurrence is a felony with 5 years in prison. So he must have accumulated, 100,000 years in jail or something, and nothing was done. So the problem we have is an executive branch that's not accountable to law, as long as they can claim that we're at war. And that seems to be the purpose of the war on terror, is to make the executive branch unaccountable. And it can do whatever it wants. Now, this guise of the war on terror, it seems to be a hoax, because other than for 9/11, September 11, 2001, which a large number of experts question seriously, other than that event, there's no known terrorist event on U.S. soil. All the so-called plots turn out to be FBI orchestrated events. So the absence of terrorists means the FBI has to make believe. So they seem to be committed to keeping alive the notion that there's a war on terror, because that means the executive branch isn't accountable. And they use this same myth, the same hoax. It's a hoax, essentially. The war on terror is a hoax. It's not real. To destroy countries. The United States is murdering people in 6 countries, maybe more, in large quantity. And it claims this is all somehow to protect us from terrorists, but we don't have any terrorist attacks. So the fact that you can have a hoax of this magnitude support what are blatant crimes, just massive crimes. Look, remember Nixon. President Nixon had to resign because he lied about when he learned about a burglary that he didn't have anything to do with. And that wasn't that long ago. And Clinton was impeached by the House, so the Senate dismissed it, because he had an affair with a White House intern. And now we have major crimes committed, not just against Americans and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, but against a vast number of Muslim peoples. We've got Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Libya, and all of this is based on lies. They're transparent lies. I mean, you have to be completely stupid to believe anything the government says about the reason for these things. And they now are trying to work their way into Syria and Iran. And again, it's all massive lies. And what's so extraordinary about it? The president, for example, will say Iran's working on nuclear weapons, nothing's off the table, blah, blah, blah. And yet the Secretary of Defense a couple of days ago said that there's no evidence that Iran is working on nuclear weapons. And the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors who are there have repeatedly reported that there's no diversion of uranium into a weapons program. In fact, most experts don't think Iran has the capability of enriching uranium to that extent in order to make a nuclear weapon. So we live in a situation where there are just massive transparent lies, and where the people who tell these lies are contradicted by their own cabinet offices, their own intelligence agents. And nothing happens. No one says, how can this be? Why is the president lying to us? Or if he's not lying, why is the CIA, why is the National Intelligence Estimate lying? Or why is the Secretary of Defense lying? Or it just all passes unnoticed. I don't really know what it means, but I suspect it means that what some of the other guests of the show have said, that the American people no longer have any input, either because there's no accountability of the government, or the government really operates independently of them, or they don't know, or if they do know, they're not prepared to go to the extremes that it takes to do something about it. So it's kind of like being in the Matrix, isn't it? I mean,
do you see a national identity card and identity chips as being in the future, since I happen to know for a fact, and we're going to be playing a segment, that there's technologies out there already testing this and embedding it? It's the size of a grain.
You know, but, Gary, who would get it? Look, Panorama on the 13th of this month, just a few days ago, ran in Britain. They showed this program, the BBC Panorama showed this program, Poor America. And there are people living in storm sewers under Las Vegas, for example. Homeless shelters are overfull, and people are now being sent off tent cities out in the woods. And how is the government going to monitor those people and get them implanted with a chip? Or
I don't think they care about those people. I think they care about all the people, such as students, anyone who has to get a driver's license, senior citizens, people that they can monitor anything they want about them. And that also, you know, that they've been, and with the Treasury Department, you were Under Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan. Now they're identifying, coding currency so they can track that currency. So a person who has cash, if we go to a cashless society, and the only way you can buy something is through an identity card that would be debited or credited, and if you were not liked by the state, or if you were considered a threat on some level, they could keep you from purchasing things that everyone else would be able to purchase. I'm just looking at the long-term consequences of what happens when we become a police state, and no one thinks it could ever get there. We think, well, that can't happen.
I think we're already there. I think we're already there, but I think those features of the police state are hard to monitor, because it takes a tremendous amount of effort and competence. But the police state doesn't need to do that. I mean, we've had police states before without this technology. And the main function of a police state simply is that the executive is unaccountable, and that citizens do not have the protection of law, because there's no rule of law. And that's what 9/11 and the war on terror had been used to get rid of, the accountability of government and the rule of law. So we're like Americans, including the very rich, if the government turns on them, are like medieval serfs. We can be picked up and thrown in a dungeon. If they want our wife or our girlfriend or our house or whatever we have, they won't. They can simply take it and throw us away. And that, I think, is the dilemma we face. The fact that we might get identity cards and be rationed and all that's entirely possible, but all that is possible because the executive is unaccountable. And it basically means Congress is irrelevant. I mean, the Congress, what power does the Congress have anymore?
Well, there are an awful lot of people who are paying attention. It's just not addressed in the mainstream media. But if you look at the alternative, look at Jesse Ventura. He reaches a lot of people. Look at Alex Jones. Reaches a lot of material. Look at the evening show overnight, whatever it is called, Across America. I don't know what
right.
it's called.
I agree with that. But like Petra said, there's no organization.
Yeah, it hasn't been organized yet, but it doesn't mean that there are not a lot of people there. There are people.
The minute you organize, there's the FBI in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So,
what do you see the solution to be?
The solution?
Yes.
I think it comes from outside the system, or else the dollar will collapse. You know, right now, the dollar is being held up by the European debt problems. But actually, the United States is in worse debt than Greece. So once all the flight from euros to dollars happens, the next thing will be to get out of dollars, and where will they go? Or it'll be some confrontation with China. I mean, the people in Washington are maniacs. Essentially, they're full of hubris and arrogance, and they believe they're the indispensable people. And the kinds of risks that they'll take are probably very large. And I think as they proceed through their list of countries that the neoconservatives drew up, you know, all that's left now is Syria and Iran, and then what they face is Russia and China. And that's a different kind of opponent. They've got nuclear weapons. They have the ability to destroy us. So I think what we really risk with all this hubris and arrogance is that we come into some kind of confrontation with power that we can't overcome.
Or if between now and that moment we end up having our own economy collapse, or a large upheaval, a protest with the working poor in the United States. We won't see our intelligentsia. They're not going to do anything. We're not going to see the professional class, lawyers, engineers, physicians. What the hell? When was the last time you saw any of the 900,000 physicians going to the streets, with rare exception? We're going to see the poor working class. Those will be the people who have absolutely nothing to lose, and they're going to lose it, as Gerald Salante says. Maybe then we'll pay attention. Right now, this is not a story with a happy ending. In fact, it's getting worse.
No, but you see, it's also the children in the middle class. All the recent college graduates, there's no jobs for them.
Well, they're the poor class now. They're not the middle class anymore. You get out of college today, you don't.
They're still living in middle class homes with their parents.
Yes, with poor class bank accounts. And I might mention today on my program, we revealed that 8.4 million American jobs, well-paying jobs, high education jobs, have been insourced by corporations hiring highly educated people from India and other countries come in and take the jobs of these Americans. We're talking about 8.4 million. Those are Homeland Security's own figures. So even the idea of having a good education, outstanding education, is not enough to protect you today. Gentlemen, we are out of time. I thank you, Professor James Petras, Professor Andrew Colin, and Professor Paul Craig Roberts, for sharing your insights with us. I'm Gary Nall. I appreciate you listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.